Good afternoon. The next case on the en banc oral argument calendar is William Scott versus State of Nevada Real Party in Interest, case number 67331. Ms. DeSoto, are you ready to go?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Justices. If it may please the court, my name is Sally DeSoto and I represent Mr. William Scott. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case comes before you on a writ of certiorari. Mr. Scott is the petitioner in this case. This case involves a traffic stop in which the officer was conducting a DUI investigation. Mr. Scott was a passenger in the vehicle, and he was arrested for advising his friend accurately of his legal rights. Accurate enunciation of the law is here. It's protected speech. Pursuant to NRS 171.123, which covers temporary detentions, it only gives the officer the right to ascertain the person's identity, and if he doesn't find probable cause of a crime, he must release him. In the case of pulling someone over, he requests the ID, the insurance, and the registration. Doing a field sobriety test, it's an election. They can choose to do it or not. So Mr. Scott was accurately advising his friend. He wasn't, you know, telling him something that wasn't true. So there's also the question under the obstruction municipal code as to whether the officer at that point was actually doing his discharge of his official duties.
Ms. DeSoto, may I interrupt you?
You may.
Apologize for just a moment. From what I recall, the driver was stopped for running a red stop sign or red light, and that's what he was initially pulled over for, and the officer observed that. And then he smelled alcohol on his breath, and that's when the questioning, from what I understand, began. That seems to me to be in part and parcel of his official duty and part of his investigation, and this happened at about 4 o'clock in the morning.
That's correct. And if he did believe that at that point the driver was intoxicated, he did have the right to take him in and have him tested.
Right, but he could have written a citation for running a stop sign.
He could
have actually arrested him for running a stop sign.
But he didn't.
Right.
So if at that point he decided he wasn't going to arrest him for running the stop sign, he could have issued him a citation, and they could have left. But certainly, the driver was under no obligation to get out and do a field sobriety test, and that's all that Mr. Scott was advising his friend of.
Okay, thank you.
But may I follow up on Justice Perry's question? Doesn't the fact of this circumstance bring this case much closer to Colton than to Hill? The fact that there was the police officer saw the guy run the red light, pulled him over, stopped him, smelled alcohol, and was processing this arrest, to me, it brings it very close to the Colton case and away from Hill, where all that was left of the statute in Hill after you took out the parts that Texas statutory state law preempted was speech. There's more to this statute here and its application than just speech. So Hill is not on all fours, I don't think.
Although under Hill, the statute, the reason I had Hill in there to begin with was because the statute doesn't directly address speech, which was similar to the municipal code in this case.
Well, but interrupt the police officer.
Well, you can interrupt the police officer in non-speech manners as well. It doesn't directly, I don't think, I'd say that speech is included in there, which is why I, you know, had more of a feeling toward Hill, where it was kind of the comparative of the statute.
Could you tell me how you distinguish Colton?
As far as Colton, You know, I can't right now. I'm sorry. I apologize.
That's fine. Thank you.
But I did want to address when the refusal to comply becomes conduct, because here it is protected speech. The Judge Russell, you know, he held that this was conduct in him refusing, but it's kind of a dubious distinction, because the conduct was speech, and this applies in every freedom of speech case. There were no fighting words here. There was no pornography. There was no intent to incite. It was just Mr. Scott advising his friend accurately as to his legal rights. And Mr. Scott was cooperative throughout. When he got out, the officer testified that he was fully cooperative. He told him that he had a knife on him. In fact, if anybody was not cooperative, it was the officer who slapped the soda out of his hand. And that surely was not Mr. Scott. But this highlights the vagueness of the municipal code. And this court has held that the second prong of the vagueness test is the most important one, where it promotes arbitrary enforcement and unfettered discretion. And the judge stated down below in the justice court that, well, once, maybe twice, but third time, surely, but why not four and five? And it gives the judges and the police officer, you know, the unfettered discretion. And the officer stated the same thing, that it was one time I ignored him, twice, three times. That was the number. But it never specifies that in the statute. The need to arrest also demonstrates the officer's inadequate management skills. I mean, why require special training for the police if it was proper to arrest at any level of interference? He had already called for backup. Backup arrived promptly, as stated in the transcripts. He could have had an officer take Mr. Scott out from the vehicle. There was a lot of other options. He could have taken them out and put them on the curb. He could have taken the driver out and talked to him there instead of arresting Mr. Scott.
So if, in fact, Mr. Scott had not said anything but instead had placed his hand over the driver's mouth when the officer was asking him the questions regarding the DUI suspicion or the moving violation, you'd have no argument here today?
I don't know. That's a really good question, because possibly, you know, because then you don't have speech involved there. It would be maybe a...
And it clearly would be conduct that was interfering with the officer doing his job.
I'm sorry?
And it clearly would have been conduct that was interfering with the officer doing his job.
It surely would have, yes. I do. I think because in this case it did involve speech, that it's protected speech, that he didn't have a right to be arrested on that, and the conviction should not stand. And how can you fix the ordinance? You'll notice that in NRS 199.280, the resisting statute, it has a mens rea element. It has willfully, which the municipal code has no mens rea to demonstrate that. Also, in NRS 199.30, it states that a person shall not directly or indirectly address any threat or intimidation to a public officer with the intent to induce such a person. You also have the mens rea in there. But also, you could also add a subsection which, you know, states that protected speech is exempted under the statute. And that's all I have. Is there any other questions?
For clarity, your position, though, is that speech is a complete prophylactic in this particular case, and as it was directed not at the officer but at his friend?
Even when it was directed at his friend and not at the officer, I think it's still protected. And to hold otherwise, I mean, where speech is conduct, to hold that it's conduct and not speech, I mean, that sort of is the case in every freedom of speech case, isn't it? That the actual conduct is the speech. So, yes, I think even when it wasn't directed at the officer, it's protected speech.
So are you seeking to facially invalidate the whole of this ordinance or just its application to your client in this?
You know, I think it's facially as well. You know, I think it violates an amount of our freedom of speech on its face.
So you don't think it's subject to a saving construction or limiting construction?
No, I don't. I think that it is invalid. It should be invalidated.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Yes.
Yes.
Other than fighting words, do you see any other type of conduct that might constitute speech that certainly would hinder and delay an investigation that may be appropriate in an instance like this?
You mean other than
somebody
speech?
In the back seat, rather than just saying to the driver, don't answer his question.
In this particular case, I'm sure that, you know, if Mr. Scott had gotten out of the car and addressed the officer, you know, say, you can't be asking him these questions, even though that speech, that has a little more body conduct involved just the speech.
Again, in another hypothetical type of situation, trying to understand this a little better, suppose he gets real aggressive in the back seat. So now all of a sudden the officer is out there without backup, without any other measure. He's focused on his investigation with this alleged DUI. And you've got some yo-yo in the back that's getting hostile and aggressive. Does he have an obligation to control the scene at that point?
I would think
so. You know,
so.
It involves speech.
Even with the speech. I mean, if you have somebody that's being aggressive in the back, then that's a whole different
situation.
Doing
nothing but mouthing off.
You know, and that was the one thing. It wasn't like Mr. Scott was calling the police officer names or any way aggressive. These were a bunch of guys with jack-in-the-box food in the car.
So to me, it seems very narrow.
In this case, it is narrow, you know, and it is a matter of just the speech. And not somebody in the back being aggressive. And certainly, you have to consider that. Consider the officer's safety. And in this case, we had officers on their way. He called them before he even told Mr. Scott to get out of the car. So they were on their way, and he told them to come soon. So they arrived promptly. I don't see this as that type of situation where he was aggressive in the back.
Right.
Would it, in your estimation, cure the constitutional issues with this statute if it were to be read to require that the person speaking intend to disrupt the police officers dealing with the crime at hand?
Absolutely.
Okay.
If there's a mens rea, you know, intent sort of language added in there, I think it would take care of the problem, just as it does in the NRS.
Well, that gets to my question, Ms. DeSoto. Are you seeking to hold the entirety of the ordinance unconstitutional facially, or just subsection 1?
Subsection 1.
Why wouldn't subsection 1 be read in the context of subsection 2? And if it were, wouldn't that supply the mens rea for the conduct that is actually obstructing the sheriff's office?
You know, it seems as if when you're reading subsection 2, it is unlawful for any person to attempt to prevent any member of the sheriff's office from Carson City from arresting any person or attempt to rescue such a member from the sheriff's office or for someone called to his aid. This would seem that almost has an intent to it. I am intending to prevent you from doing something. Mm-hmm. It's that same kind of strong language that supplies an intent already into it, I believe.
So at least with respect to the obstruction of a sheriff's officer undertaking their duty to investigate a DUI and potentially arrest a DUI suspect.
Right.
Would you read 1 and 2 together when interpreting the facial challenge?
Possibly. Possibly. I mean, you could certainly say that he was unlawfully trying to prevent his arrest, but I don't know if that's the case. I think he was just advising him accurately of his rights. And I don't exactly think that was the case in this case.
Okay. Any other questions by the court? All right. Thank you, Ms. DeSoto.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Port.
Thank you. May it please the court. Melanie Porter from the Carson City District Attorney's Office on behalf of Real Party and Interest State of Nevada. The petitioner in this case has raised a constitutional challenge to the facial validity of this statute. And so we have to assess this situation in that context. In doing so, we begin with a presumption that the ordinance at issue in this case is constitutional. That presumption was recognized by this court in the Castaneda case in 2010. It is a heavy burden for the petitioner to come before this court and have an ordinance declared to be constitutionally invalid. And it's the petitioner's burden. In order to have that declaration made today, the petitioner must show a clear invalidity for the statute. And this court must make every reasonable construction in order to save the statute from unconstitutionality.
Do you think that we should read subsection 1 to require a specific intent to hinder or delay or thwart the police officer's processing of what he believed to be the crime of DUI and running the red light?
I think that is a possibility. I think that is a method that this court could impose to save the statute. I don't think it's required. I think the statute is clear on its face.
Textually, how would we get there? If, let's say, we wanted to go with that specific intent and say, at least to the extent somebody specifically intends to mess up an arrest by being ornery in the background, you're going to tolerate this. Where do you get that specific intent from the wording of this ordinance?
I think what you can do is you can look at the mens rea that is set forth in NRS 193-190 that requires every ordinance or statute to have a mens rea element. And I think what the court would do in that situation is to look potentially at, for instance, what the Virginia court did in the Kiddo case that was cited in the briefs, where Virginia read that mens rea element by judicial construction into the statute and found that that was satisfactory to fix the issues with the statute. I think that is a possibility. That's a direction this court could absolutely go if the court finds that there's some issue with the statute on its face.
Counsel, we have, I'm looking at this sub 1, and the only part of sub 1 that seems to even come into play is the word obstruct. And I guess the verbiage that was used was not aimed at the officer. Was just merely to his friend, associate, whatever, not to respond.
Correct.
So this is not resisting. It's not delaying. It's not molest. It's not threatening to hinder. This is kind of a pure speech situation. How do we jump that room, so to speak, and really put this in obstruct when merely he's advising someone?
Because the conduct went beyond the mere advising of his friend.
What is the conduct? Because there's a distinction with the writers of this is conduct and this is speech. And we have to have a little more to get a merger of the two.
In this situation, it was the loudness with which he spoke, the persistence with which he spoke. It wouldn't have mattered, quite frankly, whether he was advising his friend of the state of the law or singing the ABC song. The issue was his conduct in yelling and talking over the officer and persistently interfering with that interaction between the officer and the suspect is where the act of obstructing came in. It wasn't what he said, it was how he said it, and that's what brings this situation more into the conduct realm than the speech realm. The officer actually gave Mr. Scott an opportunity to advise his friend and did what we would expect officers to do, to allow for some degree of interference, if you will. He let Mr. Scott advise his friend. And when Mr. Scott continued to advise his friend and talk over him, he said, I need you to back off. I need you to stop and let me proceed with my investigation. Mr. Scott didn't. He again interfered and talked over the officer who was trying to engage with Mr. Bradley. And the officer at that point said, I need you to stop, Mr. Scott.
So is that your position at that point? It wasn't simply speech. That's when the conduct and the speech merged and it became more conduct than it did speech.
That is my point, in that there was opportunity for him to exercise his First Amendment right of free speech, his ability to tell his friend what he believed the state of the law to be. But when he exceeded that by repeatedly speaking over the officer and getting in the way of the officer doing his job, it became obstructing. And that's what the trial court recognized in this case.
Was that behavior a whole lot different than the behavior in Hill? I mean, it seems like in Hill it was more exaggerated. Why don't you pick on somebody your own size? The defendant yells at the officer.
In my read of Hill, Hill's conduct was less exaggerated. Hill was away from the scene at the time. He was not in the confined space of a vehicle. He, on one occasion, told the officer to pick on someone his own size to try to divert the officer's attention. And at that point, the officer said, "Are you interrupting me in my official capacity?" and went to place him under arrest. So from my perspective and my read of the Hill case, his conduct was less egregious than the conduct exhibited by Mr. Scott in the repeated efforts to obstruct the investigation.
Is there any other distinction with Hill that you have besides what you just mentioned?
Yes, when we're talking about comparing the statutory language, I think there's a huge distinction between the statute at issue in Hill and the ordinance at issue in this case, in that the operational portion of the Hill ordinance was that the person could be arrested for conduct that in any manner interrupted the officer's investigation. When you look at that word interrupt and the way the Hill court interpreted that word interrupt, they interpret it as directly affecting verbal speech. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a pretty common sense interpretation when we talk about interruption is sort of a brief delay or a brief break in that officer's investigation. Where our statute, our ordinance, deals much more specifically, much more directly with conduct that hinders, delays, threatens, obstructs an investigation. Those words are all much more conduct-based. They denote a much more significant disruption to the officer's investigation than that word interrupts. So I think that's a big distinction between Hill and the situation we have
here. And in Hill, as I recall, the Texas state-level statute robbed that ordinance of almost any effect except for verbal interruption. Is that fair?
That is fair, and that's what the Hill court found, was that only...
So that's why the Supreme Court wasn't... They said, we're not going to abstain, we're not going to certify. There's a whole other side to the Hill case. That this case, this statute has no judicial gloss as far as I know.
Right, that's exactly what the court found, was that they were only dealing with that portion of the statute that talked about interrupting because the rest of it was fronted by other laws.
But then following Justice Douglas's point, if it's obstructing, verbally obstructing, how is that different from interrupting?
It's a much more serious interference with the investigation. And that's the point that I'm trying to make, there becomes a point where it's no longer an interruption. The first effort to advise Mr. Scott's friend of his rights, maybe that was an interruption. But when the officer is at such a point that he can no longer continue his investigation, and as he testified at trial, he had to stop his DUI investigation to deal with Mr. Scott, then it rises to the level of obstructing. You're no longer in the realm of a mere interruption. You're talking now about obstructing that officer's ability to do his job.
But doesn't that analysis take us directly to what the appellant is talking about, and that is that what may be a more serious interruption to police officer A would be a whole different story to police officer B, and therefore the statute provides no guidance as to what constitutes the level of bad interruption versus good interruption?
I don't think that's true, because I think we can all generally agree, and reasonable people can agree, at what point an officer is no longer capable of doing his job. There may be different degrees. There may be some level of discretion. That is true, and I think that's true with any sort of criminal statute that we deal with. I think about it this way. You have an officer who's investigating a battery case. He has to, on scene, make a determination what is probable cause to believe that somebody has unlawfully used force or violence. Will different officers disagree as to what constitutes an unlawful use of force or violence? Sure. May courts disagree as to what constitutes an unlawful use of force or violence? Sure. But is there at least enough guidance that we can figure it out, we can come to sort of a reasonable understanding of what that means, yes. And I think that's that same thing is true with the obstructing statute. You're talking about words that are generally understood to be a blockage, if you will, of the officer.
Quite frankly, this was a run the stop sign PC. Agreed?
For the stop, yes.
Okay. And then window comes down or whatever, and we have the aroma of alcohol. It becomes something very different then, at least from the officer's perspective. So why wasn't it okay for the their client, Mr. Scott, to simply say, zip it? I mean, you know, that's not obstructing. That's just, and even if he said it three times, to me, it still sounds like speech. And it gives this police officer, I guess I'm confusing two issues, but it gives this police officer and the next one in line the ability to interpret this ordinance in a way that would not necessarily be consistent and would give them unbridled authority to enforce as they see fit.
I think you have to balance, and I think what the officer has to balance is the Mr. Scott's ability to talk to his friend versus his ability to do his job. And when that balance shifts such that the officer is
but
no
counsel,
longer...
But, counsel, wasn't his job aimed at the driver of the vehicle?
It was.
Mr. Scott?
It was.
And it's interesting how we've segued from the conduct of the driver of the vehicle, whether he had an obligation to respond or not respond, whether he was in violation of the statute, to someone who had not directed anything to the officer and not intervened, and all of a sudden we're dragging this person in. We live in a very turbulent time right now in terms of action and conduct of people. And as you said, discretion. And I'm very concerned with the application of this when you have someone who's not threatening, not inducing conduct on his behalf to get in between the officer and this person, or even holding him back by the shoulders to say don't go. It's just very troubling.
That's my concern is application, because I wondered if this was a mother-daughter situation, a father-son situation. Or what if the guy, his father wasn't a lawyer, but what if he was a lawyer? He was saying, this is my client, don't speak. I mean, according to you, could be arrested for, especially if he said it three times. Maybe they'd arrest him after the second time or the third time. Maybe he'd say it five times. But I don't see the obstruction here. I don't, as it's applied to Scott. So
I see it at the point where he interjects himself into that investigation to such a degree that the officer can no longer continue that investigation. That's where it becomes obstruction, regardless of whether it's a mother-daughter or, you know, any other.
I think the officer had an obligation to say, step aside, to remove the guy from the car, go talk to him privately, and, you know, make the situation not so volatile. Like Justice Douglas said, this is wonderful that it happened in Carson City. I'm glad it didn't happen in Las Vegas on the west side of town or some other place where it could cause a real problem.
And I think to some degree the trial court looked at that issue and said that it didn't find that it was reasonable for the officer to do anything else in that situation. When you have one officer back up on the way, but you've got one officer on scene, you've got three people in a car, he's trying to speak with the driver, and he's got one person who is loud, who's interfering with his ability. He doesn't know what that person is going to do. He has obvious concerns for his safety, for the safety of those around him, the other people in the car.
Also, that's not in the record that he felt threatened or anything of that nature. The only thing in the record is he's advised this other person not to answer.
Not that he felt threatened, but the officer did testify at trial that he wasn't certain what Mr. Scott was going to do, and so he called for backup and asked for them to expedite because he was concerned for his safety, and that was reflected in the trial court's judgment.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. Let's change the scenario slightly. Let's say, we'll go back to the conduct issue Justice Perigar brought up. Let's say that Mr. Scott was drunk. Let's assume he was drunk, boisterous, loud, but he starts screaming at the driver saying, now you cooperate with the officer, and does just the opposite and admonishes Mr. Scott to the point that the officer can't do his job, you know, like that. How would that scenario play into based on the wording of this ordinance?
I think that is again obstructing, because you're engaging in some conduct that prevents that officer from doing his job, whether it's to tell him to cooperate or not to cooperate, it matters not what he says, but how he's saying it, how he's acting. If he was just yelling, just to yell, it would be obstructing. It's the same idea, regardless of what comes out of his mouth.
So if he whispers Miranda, he doesn't get arrested. But if he starts shouting, Miranda, Miranda, he gets arrested. Is that right?
Your Honor, I'm beyond my time. May I?
Well, you can answer if you want.
Might be merciful.
Good time to sit down.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Soto, you have a minute.
I did want to quickly address Justice Pickering's question regarding Colton. In Colton, you had one guy which attracted several other people. They were outside the vehicle, so there was truly a safety issue as to other traffic coming around, and for the officer, because everybody was outside the vehicle, and that was not the case here. So there was no outside safety to anybody coming by or to the officer.
Right, but to deal with the backseat interruption or obstruction, if you will, that people are suggesting you should take the guy out of the car and break the scene up, then you would have had the same situation.
Well, but the officers arrived promptly, so that he could have technically just waited until his backup arrived. And the officer has plenty of time. He has an hour to detain, you know, the arrestee or the person, and 2 hours to collect evidence. So it's not like it was time of the essence kind of thing.
And the Colton case has a much more specific intent requirement in the statute.
True. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Soto. Any other questions by the court? All right, thank you very much. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and brief. The case will stand submitted.